happen to be a reader, if you happen to be a lover of fiction, this is the hour during which you will want to make your contribution. So that number again, 202-885-8850, or make your secure contribution online at WAMU.org. And thank you.
First screening of Charlie Chaplin's The Gold Rush, 1925. First year that WAMU began broadcasting, 1961. Your first contribution to WAMU? Perhaps today. First-time members are especially important to WAMU because it means you recognize the importance of public radio in your life and your community. Your gift today keeps WAMU strong tomorrow. Contribute now at 800-248-8850 or online at WAMU.org. There's nothing like the first time.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Nandi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. First revealed her passion for Western literature in her best-selling memoir, Reading Lolita in Tehran, describing how she and her students found a form of liberation in fundamentalist Iran by reading forbidden Western novels. Now, author Azar Nafisi is worried that great works of fiction are being banished from American schools as well, replaced by dry nonfiction texts and a push for practicality over creativity. In her new book, The Republic of Imagination, the author says it's essential to teach important works of great fiction by Mark Twain, Sinclair Lewis, James Baldwin, even in a democratic society. Joining me to look at the value of fiction in American education is Azar Nafisi. Her new book is called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. She's a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and she joins us now in studio. Azar Nafisi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you have questions or comments for Azar Nafisi, give us a call at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org, shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show, or go to our website, kojoshow.org, ask a question, make a comment there. You have a deep appreciation for Mark Twain's novel, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. It's a satire on the antebellum South set along the Mississippi River. It's the first book you taught when you went back to Iran in 1979 after attending school in the U.S. Why do you think Huck Finn is such an important character in American fiction?
Mark Twain talks about Huck Finn is a book about the conflict between a sound heart and a deformed conscience, in which the heart wins. And I think that that aspect of America that I connect to is about the conquest of the heart. And I felt that Huck Finn was sort of the father of new fiction in America. It created a new reality. It was sort of a declaration of independence, not just from Europe, but from those people Mark Twain called the Mayflower tribe. And he tells them, you know, you deprived me of my ancestors. And he begins with the Native Americans, goes through the Quakers, goes through the witches, and ends with the slave. And he says, you deprived me of this, and I am a many-shaded, exquisite mongrel, and I love that, and I think that is how great American fiction begins.
Huck conceals his identity, breaks the rules, but we believe him to be good at heart. Why is that relevant, particularly in an authoritarian society, and for that matter, in American society today?
You talked about your readers being, your
being
audience
readers.
Being readers, a great deal of them. And the point about both reading and writing, and the point about Huck Finn, and I think that especially with American fiction is the moral guardian of the American reality. With Huck Finn, you notice that he doesn't talk directly about the most heinous thing in American society, which is slavery. He doesn't talk about it directly. But what he does, he goes and questions the worst thing that human beings can do to one another, that is not see the other as an individual. And Huck himself lives in a racist society, so he does have racist tendencies. places. But Jim sort of resurrects Huck. Jim is the first person after Huck fakes his death and escapes from Miss Watson and Pap. Jim is the first person who sees Huck. And through eyes of Jim, Huck is resurrected. And through relationship with Jim, he more and more accepts Jim as equal, because they're two individuals whose heart can break. And he says it is wrong for a father to be separated from his family. It is amazing. It doesn't preach to us. It puts us within that experience.
You say the novel's true message is that ordinary people who participate in institutions like slavery are ultimately responsible for them. What do you mean by that?
They
and why
sure
is that
are.
An important lesson today?
You know, and that is another great thing about fiction. It brings out the complexities that ideology takes away from us. It shows you people who are very good-hearted and decent, like Aunt Sally. You know, she's worried about Huck, you know, but she cannot see Jim or an African-American as another human being. And Mark Twain is very clever. There's a scene where she asks Huck, "You weren't hurt, were you?" He said, "No, only, you know, a slave was killed." And she says, "Well, then it was nobody," something like that. And she's a good woman. And yet, she's a racist. You need that consciousness, and you need to know that in a democratic society, you are responsible.
You point to Sinclair Lewis as another important American author. Talk about his novel, Babbitt, a satire on the vacuousness of middle-class American life in the early 20th century. What does the character George Babbitt represent today?
Well, George Babbitt is sort of anti-Huck. And I felt that, you know, there's this contradiction and paradox at the heart of American society, and we are pulled this way and the other way. And I think that right now, George Babbitt's mentality, his attitude, is what is gaining dominance over that other part, over the heart. You know, when we glorify greed, when we tell our children to go to school in order to be career ready, when we destroy our public schools, taking away funding, and we think people are moochers if they want great public education and great public health, then I think Babbitt is very relevant today.
We are Babbittizing the society today.
We use the same language, job creators. That is exactly, I mean, it exactly comes out of Babbitt, the kind of language we use.
You mentioned it already, so I'd like to get to it. One of the themes of your book is the value of reading fiction, even as public schools in the U.S. seem to be moving away from novels toward more nonfiction texts. How do you think American education is being Babbittized and becoming, first and foremost, a path to a career?
It is, you know, there is American pragmatism. The best of it you could find both actually in the founders, when George Washington said, "We need both literature and science as the basis of our education." When Frederick Douglass talked about, "We need to think with our heads and with our heart, with our minds and with our hands." So, education, knowledge, no matter whether it is humanities or science, is related to us. What is happening in our public schools is we're telling children that the only important thing about knowledge is a vocation. A democracy, you know, a society should provide all its citizens with the opportunity to have a good education. You know, there should be not one single individual who goes to school just for a vacation. Your vocation should be your passion. That is the difference between a democracy and a non-democratic society.
Azar Nafisi, author of Reading Lolita in Tehran. Her new book is The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. She's a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. She joins us in studio. You too can join the conversation by calling 800-433-8850. What for you is the right balance of quote-unquote informational texts and fiction for public school students? 800-433-8850. Should students in public schools be educated primarily or merely to find a job, build a career, or should there be more to an education? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Azar, what does fiction offer students that they don't get from nonfiction texts? Why is cultivating the imagination so important?
Well, also, you know, I'm not against nonfiction texts. They level nonfiction texts. I mean, the Gettysburg Address is now on the same par as, I don't know, EPA
guidelines,
you know, and they take out the context. They tell students when you read Gettysburg Address, you should not be thinking of funerals. You should not be thinking of the history. You should only be looking at the text as if it's a multiple choice question. With fiction, you go beyond appearances. Fiction is the land of Oz in the middle of the desert. You need to leave reality and to see it through the deep and alternative eyes of others in order to come back to reality and to be able to relate to the world as well as change the world.
You've said that by de-emphasizing fiction, our education system is buying into an American expectation that life should be easy and as painless as possible. How does reading fiction help people whose lives or help people understand that life is not always rosy?
Well, take Huck Finn itself. Take any of the books I talk about in this book or any other great book. Take Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Are Watching God or Saul Bellow's Herzog. At the heart of it is, I mean, it is not just tyranny of man. It is tyranny of time. We all die. We all lose. We all confront pain. Fiction shows us a way to confront pain, not to evade it. Our children nowadays say we cannot read Merchant of Venice or Huck Finn because it is too violent and we will become traumatized. For heaven's sake, you're giving Malala Nobel Prize. And this girl, every time she talks about herself, she's renewing that day when she was shot. And yet you cannot read Huck Finn because it traumatizes you. What kind of Americans? Is that the American dream? Is that why we talk about Brazilians, the American spirit?
We seem to be living in a society in which people no longer have an expectation of death at all.
No, we're living forever, and that is why reality right now is far more fictional than fiction. And by the way, when people talk about vocations, you notice, Kojo, they're not talking about teachers, librarians, booksellers, museum curators as jobs. You know?
Yes, they're not jobs. They're, I guess, they're not jobs, they're not passions, they're just hobbies, I guess.
Yeah, they now are luxuries, you know?
Yeah.
They're now luxuries. And why people are telling us this who send their own children to private schools, who have music, who have poetry. What kind of a democracy are we defining?
We're talking with Azar Nafisi. Her latest book is called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. Let's go to the phones and start with Dave in La Plata, Maryland. Dave, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo, and I really enjoy listening to the guest, the speaker there. Some of the points that I don't agree with is the comment about we're taking money away from the public schools. All the rich white folks are putting their kids in public or in private schools and have these things. And you had an article on last week where we looked at and talked briefly the quality of education. If you look at the output, is not directly tied to the amount of money that's being put in it. If you look at the amount of money that's spent per capita on some of the students in some of the areas, as opposed to other, it does not equate with the quality of education. It does not equate with the achievement and knowledge learned.
We did have a broadcast about that last week, comparing the amount of money that was spent in a variety of school districts and trying to figure out exactly how that money was spent and what was the return on that money. But what, in your view, is the quality of education of which you speak?
I apologize. Would you just repeat that?
When you say the quality of education, what are you talking about?
I'm a firm believer in measuring things. In trying to take some of the subjectivity out of it. So academic achievement, as whether it's language skills, the ability to write, ability for critical thinking, mathematic, engineering skills. If you look at how those are assessed and how America performs and you look at various schools, it is not tied to, it does not equate to how many dollars we put in that.
I think we could all agree on that, but where do you see the arts playing a role in this? Where do you see fiction playing, reading of fiction in public schools playing a role in this?
I think it's tremendously important, and I absolutely wholeheartedly agree with the speaker's point about, frankly, it's ludicrous and it is very alarming that we would remove Mark Twain, Huck Finn, the works of Mark Twain and others because it's too violent. I think that's, ridiculous.
Thank you very much for your call. Care to comment?
Yes, I agree with a lot of things that David mentioned. I wanted I'm not, sort of polarizing between the rich and the poor when I talk about the quality of education. I'm sorry if I gave that impression. And I agree with you that money is not all. An innovative mind can do so much without money. What I'm objecting to is taking the funding away from arts and music and fiction in public schools today. It wasn't the fault of literature the quality has dropped in our schools. Science and literature go hand in hand. Science and literature are both based on curiosity, on passion, on the urge to discover. We should not segregate them. We should teach them together. And this is at least what the founders in this country wanted. This is what the greatest men and women in this country wanted. We are taking art, because we call it luxury, out of public schools, and we're going to suffer for it.
On, therefore, and thank you for your call, we are going out to Rachel in Silver Spring, Maryland. Rachel, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you so much for taking my call. I was a high school English teacher for several years, and now I'm a social worker in a D.C. school. And I wish with all my heart that we could teach, and there was this great love of learning, and that was the motivation of all students. And I taught Huck Finn for many years, and I love literature, but many of my students are reading years and years and years below grade level. Some are in, middle school and barely literate, unfortunately. And I just think that the idea that, education, that we are working with all of our students for this love of education and love of learning, it doesn't deal with the reality that exists in our schools right now and the reality that school teachers are facing. I have conversations with students, about motivation, and it is very vocation driven, because my conversations are like, well, what do you want to ultimately get to, and how is this going to help you? Because they are not motivated to learn at all. So I just wanted to make that comment.
I'm glad you brought that up, because we have had discussions on this broadcast before about how does one motivate students who have low reading novels. We've had conversations with graphic novelists and found that has been a great way to get students who are not much interested in reading to read. But if you would address Rachel's comments about low reading levels and how that affects the ability to teach fiction in public schools.
Yes, one of the interesting things is that why is it that this is happening now? Because this country has been having humanities and fiction for a long time. But it is within the past few decades that we're seeing this drop in both mathematics and reading. So the problem is not fiction, I don't think. But the other thing is my two children both went to public schools, and my daughter is so adamant that she wants to live somewhere where she says morally she cannot send her child to a private school. Her husband, now they just got married, he also went to public school. He said that his public school was much poorer than hers, and that the best teachers were overworked and underpaid and underappreciated, and then they would leave. And so what we need to do, we need to say with Frederick Douglass that teaching is one of the most sacred jobs in any society, that they are the apple of our eyes, and we should first encourage teachers to be motivated and find creative ways. I've never had problem teaching literature, even when students started saying, why are we reading this? We read this before in high school, you know.
You also look at life through the lens of author Carson McCullers and her 1940 novel, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. What does that novel by Carson McCullers say about loneliness and the difficulty of communicating with others, and why is that still relevant today?
Well, actually, that was one of the reasons I chose Carson McCullers is because I felt those mongrels that Huck Finn, that Mark Twain talks about, all gather in Carson McCullers. They're all quote-unquote outcasts, but they're outcasts because they cannot connect to the society, because that society is not responding to the passions they have in them. You know, Mick, the young girl, wants to be a musician. She does anything possible to become one, but then she has to go work because her family doesn't have any money. Jake Blunt is a labor agitator, and he becomes more and more radicalized and isolated because nobody's listening to him. Dr. Copeland worries about the future of his people. He's an African-American doctor whose people are timid in order to fight. And by the way, he predicted the March on Washington tells Jake Blunt that maybe the solution is on a march on Washington for the black people. And the only hope for connection for these people coming out of their isolation is to be able to fulfill their passion. And I feel that this is true today as it was then.
The fulfillment of passion, just one of the themes of Azar Nafisi's latest book. It's called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be continuing with our fall membership campaign. But if you have called to join this conversation with Azar Nafisi, stay on the line, or you can still call 800-433-8850. Send email to kojo@wamu.org. What do you feel is the biggest benefit of reading novels? You can also shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the city of Houston, Texas, home to the 55-acre Texas Renaissance Festival during October and November. More information is at visithouston.com. And from Green Acres School in North Bethesda, encouraging pre-K through 8th grade students to think creatively in a challenging environment since 1934. Open house October 26th. Registration at greenacres.org. And from Zuckerman Spader, a national litigation boutique representing law firms and lawyers across the country in legal malpractice suits, ethics investigations, and business counseling. When the lawyer you choose matters most. Online at Zuckerman.com.
It's the third day of WAMU 88.5's fall membership campaign, when we encourage you to become a member of WAMU 88.5 so we can continue to bring you the programming that you have been listening to. You can do that right now by calling 202-885-8850. We have a goal this hour of $7,000. You can also make your secure contribution online at WAMU.org. We're asking you to help us meet that goal of this hour, $7,000. We set a goal every hour so that we would have a realistic measure of how well or how badly we are doing in this campaign so far. We would like you to help us to do well. Joining me now in studio is this show's managing producer, Brendan Sweeney.
Hi, Kojo. Again, the number is 202-885-8850, 202-885-8850, or WAMU.org. We are off to the races. We have a goal of $7,000 for this hour. We have $6,131 to go. So we are on our way, and I am very confident that we are going to make it. Very much enjoying your conversation right now.
We're talking with Azar Nafisi. She is the author of the book, the new book, The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. And while we're talking about imagination, Brendan Sweeney, it is one of the things that we do on this broadcast is to try to stimulate the imaginations of our listeners by having authors like Azar Nafisi on this broadcast. We think that one of the reasons you listen to public radio in general and the Diane Rehm show and this show in particular is because you hear a lot of discussions about books on those shows that, in fact, do help to stir your imagination. We'd like you to become a member, not just a listener. So call now, 202-885-8850. You can become a member by making your contribution online at WAMU.org.
Indeed, Kojo. You know, one of the hallmarks of public radio is hearing about the world from other perspectives. If we wanted to hear our own perspectives parroted back to us, there are plenty of media outlets that do that very well. You know, that's just the way the media shakes out right now. But this is the only place where you will hear views that challenge you, where you will hear deep takes on topics you thought you understood. And as you said, you guys are talking with Azar Nafisi about how books like Huckleberry Finn had a deep impact on her. And in this case, how we would do well to study our own classics here in the U.S. How often have you heard an author interview or one of Diane Rehm's signature reader review segments and felt motivated to pick up a book on your shelf or head down to a bookstore, or in these electronic days, get a new ebook? If you've found that our book coverage has motivated you to become a more literate person, think about picking up the phone and calling 202-885-8850 or WAMU.org.
For just $5 a month, you can support WAMU 88.5 and help commemorate a very special occasion. The Big Broadcast Shopping Tote is a golden opportunity to show your love for WAMU 88.5 and the Big Broadcast as we celebrate its 50th anniversary. The Shopping Tote is black with the Big Broadcast 50 years imprinted in gold. Check it out at WAMU.org or call 800-248-8850.
A way of saying thank you for your gift for becoming a member. If you're calling right now, that number is 202-885-8850, or you can make your contribution online at WAMU.org. One of the things we're going to be talking about when we come back, Brendan, I should say one of the authors we'll be talking about, is James Baldwin. And you were talking about earlier about reading about people or reading writers from different perspectives from around the world and how that can give you insight into other people's lives. Reading James Baldwin is one of the reasons I wanted to come to this country in the first place, because when he began to raise questions of identity in his writing, I was living at the time in Guyana, South America. It was British Guyana. It was a colonial country. And I was, as a teenager, undergoing the same kinds of questions about identity that he was describing, but in a completely different political and social context. So reading James Baldwin made me curious about searching for identity in the context of this country, and that's one of the reasons I came here.
Okay, I challenge you to bring that up during the interview segment of this, because that's a fascinating observation. I should say about the book coverage, our book coverage is coordinated by you, Kojo, and by our producer, Taylor Burney. We get a lot of books sent to us, and we are very intentional about the authors that we decide to interview on this show. We speak with authors of fiction who are playing with interesting or provocative ideas. You spoke with Laird Hunt recently about the latest book, Never Home, which was about women who fought in the Civil War posing as men.
Amazing stories.
You also had a recent conversation with Paulo Coelho about adultery, which was fascinating, and you guys got along incredible. It was actually a hilarious interview.
Even though he was in a different location, I felt like I'd known this man all my life.
And we've also talked to fascinating writers of unique memoirs. Earlier this month, we spoke to Daisy Hernandez about her book, A Cup of Water Under My Bed, which told of the pressures that are brought to bear on children of first-generation immigrants from places like Colombia and Cuba, and what it's like to be brought up as to realize that you are bisexual in a very heteronormative environment. And then my favorite one that I just wanted to flag was you spoke with Tim DeNevi, who wrote a book, Hyper, which was a fascinating personal memoir that explored what it was like to grow up with an ADHD diagnosis. Riveting radio. Diverse voices telling unique stories. That's the hallmark of WAMU. You know that you value it and that you listen to it, so now it's time to pick up the phone. 202-885-8850 or WAMU.org.
In other words, if you're a reader, you know that NPR in general and WAMU in particular is a regular location for you. We're asking you to help to support that location, help it to continue bringing you the programming you've been enjoying. If you make a contribution of $120 a year, that's just $10 per month, as a thank you gift, you will get the NPR WAMU pint glass. It's a 16-ounce pint glass with the NPR logo on one side, the WAMU logo on the other. Very simple. It's just a glass, a pint glass, but it'll have your favorite station and your favorite network's images on the line. So make that contribution now. Give us a call, 202-885-8850. Help us reach our goal of $7,000 this hour, or you can go to our website and make a secure contribution online at WAMU.org. And thank you.
Hi, this is Ari Shapiro from NPR News. When you listen to the news from NPR on WAMU 88.5, you get truth and passion. We check the facts to give you a true picture of events, and we talk to people who feel passionately about what's at the heart of the matter. Your financial support makes this all possible, so please contribute now. Call 1-800-248-8850 or visit online at WAMU.org. Your gift sustains WAMU today and in the future. Thank you.
Welcome back. Our guest is Azar Nafisi. Her latest book is called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. She's a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. If you've called 800-433-8850, stay on the line. We will get to your call. If the lines are busy, shoot us an email to koju@wamu.org. We mentioned it in the break. You're also a fan of novelist James Baldwin. Yes. How did he, like his character John Grimes in Go Tell It on the Mountain, obey his heart and write what he wanted to write?
Oh, Baldwin is all heart.
Yes, that's true.
You know, I know that he loved James. Twain was not, you know, among his most favorite.
But
I felt that he was the true progeny of Huck and Jim. I felt that, you know, the whole point about Baldwin, what interested me a lot, I identified with him in many ways, but what interested me was he was both very, very concerned about reality, mm-hmm. and he was a great civil rights activist, as you know, mm-hmm. and he was also passionate about writing. He didn't compromise on his writing. He didn't turn into an ideologue. And he had an alternative way of looking at the world. You remember he says, as long as you think you're white, I am forced to be black. Mm-hmm. You know, Baldwin is the universal writer and the universal activist. He transcends boundaries, gender,
ideology,
and race, and he gets it from both sides. And that shows his strength, that he doesn't leave them happy.
And even though, as you pointed out, he was active in the civil rights movement, he saw himself first and foremost and finally as a writer.
As a writer. And I mentioned in my book that when I read Baldwin's Go and Tell It on the Mountain for this book, I remembered another book that was published 2 years before that, which was J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, which got the title of the Great American Novel. I think Baldwin deserves that book, Go Tell It on the Mountain, it opens to us a new perspective on America, a new character and a new language. He, like Twain, creates a new language. And we constantly just want to identify him as a gay writer and an African-American writer. He was both, but he was a writer. He belongs to the world.
Which brings up the question, why is Baldwin on the decline in public schools today?
Why is he? That is a good question. First of all, I noticed, you see, everything now, I hate generalizations. Obviously, I wouldn't be sitting talking to you if everything is what I'm saying. It's too much of an example. But the dominant trend today, alongside of comfort and vocation, is entertainment. You know, we don't want to be bothered. You know, Ray Bradbury used to say, you don't have to destroy a culture by burning books. You just get people to stop reading books. And this culture of comfort, this culture of comfort food, easy, one-night stands with ideas and imagination, doesn't leave room for writers like Baldwin. But I think the students, once they get into him, they will not easily get out of it.
This is true. Certainly it was that in my case. Here now is Jeffrey in Baltimore, Maryland. Jeffrey, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
I can't believe it. This is so exciting. I am a WAMU pledger, by the way, Kojo.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I want to offer the author, whose name I don't want to flub, but reading Lolita and Huck Finn in USA as a possible next edition title, reading Lolita and Huck Finn in USA. And really, that was what I called about, I also want to thank you so much for talking about the other authors you've mentioned. I really don't know a lot of James Baldwin, although I love Ralph Ellison and was thankfully given it in my white Anglo-Saxon Protestant school to read as a teenager. And lastly, I've got my notebook out, and I'm taking paper notebook, and I'm taking copious notes.
Okay, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
Get a comment?
You know, this is the best thing about books. This is the best thing about having a passion. You connect to people you have never met, and they come to your home, which is your heart.
It's been a decade since you wrote Teaching Lolita in Tehran, and since then you've become an American citizen, having immigrated to the U.S. in 1997. How do you think Iranian students today would respond to American literature?
Iranian students, when the world was taken away from it, they connected to the world through the best that the world had to offer. And if you go on some of these sites, Iranian sites, the youth, you notice that they know much more about their American peers. They still read, they know the Tocqueville. And what my argument in this book is that you don't have to be deprived of something in order to love it. That there can be no democracy without a democratic imagination.
On now to Matthew in Ashburn, Virginia. Matthew, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to call in just from my own little personal experience growing up with reading fiction and what it taught me, which was I had been in a family which pushed really hard for me to learn sciences, learn math, learn computer science, a very technical-oriented education. And what I discovered on my own, partially through some of the English lit courses in high school and the fiction I was being asked to read, but more on my own, as I read on my own outside of school, was I found it amazing how much fiction allowed me to better understand people and and relate to people and, become much more empathetic, sympathetic to others. And the idea to me that this is being taken away from kids, I find quite appalling. I mean, it wasn't, not that it was that big, not that it was pushed that hard even when I was in school, but that it's mind-boggling to me that we have a society now in which a key component, I think, of being a better person, being better global citizens, understanding other cultures is being taken away from us. I mean, that is, at least it's taken away from our kids.
Glad you mentioned other cultures because, Azar Nafisi, you studied American literature, and that's what you've taught both in Iran and here in the U.S. But what other countries, what other cultures are producing literature that you admire and that should be taught to American students?
You know, Koja, I mentioned in my book that when I was very young, about 3 or 4 years old, my father would read me stories, and he was very democratic about it. We'll have Iranian stories, right, by the Turkish stories, like by the Arabic, like by Pinocchio from Italy, Little Prince from France, Little Match Girl from Hans Christian Andersen. So from very early childhood, I learned that the Republic of Imagination is a space where everybody is equal. Nobody asks you, are you a Republican or a Democrat? Nobody asks you when you go into a bookstore or a library, who did you vote for? What color skin do you have? So that and the reason I talked about American fiction was because I graduated in American fiction, but I have from Flaubert and Jane Austen to Pamuk and Najib Mahfouz, the Republic of Imagination is one place.
What can fiction tell us about what's going on in the world right now, in the Middle East, in Africa, and in Iran?
I'm so glad you mentioned it because the previous caller also was talking about it. I'm wondering how could we have great policymakers who have no idea about the ancient cultures of Turkey or Lebanon or Iran. How do we talk about a religion, Islam, when we think that there is a monolithic religion called Islam, where everybody looks the same and acts the same, while there are numerous ways of looking at this religion, as it is with Christians. It's like saying that all Americans, the majority of Americans are Christians, and so from tomorrow, all Americans should wear crosses and go to one church, let's say Southern Baptist. So the whole point about it is that even our policymakers know nothing or very little. I always talk about Iran. I say, go to our epic poet Ferdowsi, who wrote 1,000 years ago, and look at the women there who not only chose their wives, they chose their lovers.
These are cultures that people can understand so much better through reading fiction that emanates from those cultures. I think that's what Martha, well, let's hear what Martha in Arlington has to say for herself. Martha, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hello, Kojo. I love your show. Can you hear me?
We hear you very well.
I'd like to thank Nazar Afisi for leading me and my book group to read Lolita and Great Gatsby and all those wonderful books in your first book. And now you have given us a program for the next year.
Oh, how lovely of you.
She is assigning your book reading group topics for the next year. Now you're going to be reading Huckleberry Finn, won't you?
Again and again.
Well, you guys have to be in touch. You have to tell me what you think of these books.
Oh, we will. Wonderful.
And I think all book groups should get together, keep our bookstores and libraries alive.
Thank you very much for your call, Martha. Are you optimistic that fiction will regain its rightful place in American schools?
I think, you know, stories have been with us since the dawn of history. That is how people describe through Greek and Roman mythology to Bible and Quran and Torah. They described what was not describable. They articulate what was not articulable. So no matter how people would try to deprive us of fiction, fiction will remain. Totalitarian societies should teach us that. Hitler burned books. Stalin called Fitzgerald and Hemingway decadent and put the best poets in gulags. Fiction stayed. Stalin died. This is how it's going to be.
Here is Marcia in Washington, D.C. Marcia, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. I hear something from your broadcast almost every day, well, at least a few times a week, that makes me want to call you because it relates to our experience, but I just listen. And this time I couldn't just listen. Well, what an extraordinary discussion since I even called. I was saying that it related to Children's Studio School because for these now 37 years of our life, we were born together. We were working together when you were writing your books because everything we do is based on imagination and invention and curiosity and the poetry of life, so that we only engage highly developed artists and architects, writers, visual performing artists to be the teachers, not additional teachers, to children so young. So anyway, this is how we've worked, and children have grown into being everything that anyone else, you know, the career, we don't talk about that, but they've become international economists and developers.
And fiction and art plays a significant role in all of that.
You know how to sum it.
I'm so glad that you brought this up, your last caller. All I wanted to say is that I'm sure that the majority of Americans, and I never dare to speak on behalf of people, but in this case, I think I'm positive. Majority of Americans don't want their country to be known to their children and to the world as only a military complex. Our military power is not our real power. The power in every culture comes from its history, and it comes from its imagination and its mind. And American people, if they want to keep that, then they should really pay attention.
Our public schools should be allowing kids to explore their imagination through fiction. Here is Robin in Washington, D.C. Robin, your turn.
Hi, thank you. I am thrilled to have to thank both of you for the program, and particularly Ms. Nafisi. my children are half Persian, and as the mother, and I'm American, I have learned so much about the richness of your culture and the strength of the women within the Persian culture. And I want to thank you for illuminating a lot of our own literature for us as Americans, but also for being such an articulate voice for as an Iranian woman. I just wanted to thank you because I think it's so important that more people in our own country here understand that the diversity of views coming from Iran.
I very much appreciate you saying that. Part of the reason I wrote Reading Lolita in Tehran, I wanted Americans to understand ordinary Iranians and to see how various they are. I suggest that people look at Persian art, listen to Persian music, read Persian history, and my God, the most sensual thing of all, and most probably you know about it, is eat Persian food. Talk about sensual pomegranates and walnuts and duck. My God, yes, Persia. That
is
another.
On Wednesdays on this broadcast, we usually discuss food, and I think you've just given us some other ideas. Azar Nafisi is speaking about her new book, The Republic of Imagination, at Politics and Prose here in Washington on Friday, October 24th at 7 p.m. That is at Politics and Prose on Connecticut Avenue, Friday, October 24th, 7 p.m. What are you working on next? Are you thinking about writing a novel by any chance?
Novel is so high in my, that I don't dare. But I can never just articulate an idea without a narrative. Right now, this is my obsession. I want to talk the rest of my life about the importance of imagination.
Azar Nafisi, she is the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran. Her new book is called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. She is a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you. And Kojak, may I say something?
I'm going to let you say it after a short break. Okay. She's not leaving us because we are coming back and we're going to be talking a little bit more about our fall membership campaign in which Azar Nafisi has been chosen to, so to speak, play a role. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Pepco, offering customers online energy management tools through My Account to help them save energy. Learn more at pepco.com.
I'm Marco Werman from PRI's The World. Surprises are nice, but most of us like to see what's coming. That's one of the reasons you listen to the station during the day, to keep on top of the news and tap into the day's events. When I'm not in our newsroom, I'm still eager to know what's going on, and public radio is a great source for live news and information. That's one of the reasons I support it. You can count on this station to bring you important stories as they happen. Show your support now for the programming you listen to every day. Here's how.
You can do that very easily by picking up the phone and calling 202-885-8850. Our volunteers are here in the station with us, here to take your telephone calls. So please call now. Our goal this hour is $7,000. We still have $4,491 to go and about 5 minutes to get there. We think you can absolutely help us to do that by making an investment in WAMU 88.5 by calling 202-885-8850 or making your contribution online at WAMU.org. Managing producer Brendan Sweeney now joins me in studio.
That's right, Kojo. The number is 202-885-8850 or WAMU.org. We have a goal of $7,000. We are $4,491 to go. That was a great conversation we just had. We let it go a little bit long because that's what we do when we have great conversations, but now it's time to get on the phone. 202-885-8850 or WAMU.org.
One of the reasons we let that conversation go long is because Azar Nafisi is not only an NPR listener, she was a listener to WAMU 88.5, and like a few other members, hopefully more, are doing today, she has something to say.
Yes, I just wanted to... There's a quote from Vladimir Nabokov. He says, readers are born free and they ought to remain free. Listeners and readers, being free means responsibility. If we want to keep our power as listeners and readers, we have to support those institutions, those people, those individuals and groups who are making it possible. The name on this show, and Diane Reams, whom I love as much as you, in a different way, they... are giving you voices and giving back your voices to us. So, Koja, if I may, I just wanted to make a very small contribution.
Thank you.
Because I feel at home here, and there are very few places I feel more at home.
Azar Nafisi is a member now of WAMU 88.5. We're encouraging you to do the same. This is an investment, and the return for your investment, you can hear it every single day when you turn the radio on. We know that there are those of you who keep WAMU 88.5 on 24/7, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so we would like you to make an investment to help to maintain us. 202-885-8850 is the number to call, or you can make your secure investment online at WAMU.org.
The number again is 202-885-8850, 202-885-8850. As Kojo was hinting there, the amount is not really what's important. The most important element is that you do make the call and give. We'll run through a number of different premiums, which we use as thank you gifts. If you give at the $5 a month level or $60, we have this fantastic big broadcast tote. At the $10 a month, $120 level, the WAMU NPR pint glass, which I can vouch for, is very sturdy because my three-year-old dropped it on the floor the other day. And maybe if you can do a little bit more at the $100 a month or $1,200 gift level, you can join WAMU's Leadership Circle, which entitles you to a day sponsorship, attendance at a special reception, and a very cool WAMU microphone pin. The number doesn't really matter all that much. It just matters that you call it. 202-885-8850 or WAMU.org.
And if you are like Brendan but not had part of his education in London, when he says pint, he usually means a pint.
We don't know what's inside of that pint
exactly
glass.
Exactly right. In that pint glass. But we'd like you to become a sustaining member. I have become a sustaining member of WAMU so that every month I see a deduction in my checking account that goes to WAMU. You become a sustaining member so that that $240 a year contribution becomes a contribution of $20 a month that would be deducted. We would love for you to become a sustaining member. That tells us that you're not just listening or contributing on this one occasion, but that you'd like to do it on an ongoing basis. You can do that now. Our volunteers are standing by to hear your call. They'll take whatever information you choose to give them about that at 202-885-8850, or you can go online and do the same thing at our website, WAMU.org.
And we had that great quote during that conversation, the Ray Bradbury quote about how totalitarian regimes don't have to burn books. They just have to convince people not to read them. And I really appreciated what we were talking about in that conversation about how we live in an on-demand society where we're kind of encouraged to be lazy. But our experience on this show is that you can take even the densest text, and if it's has ideas that are dynamic and that move, a producer or Kojo can be the entry point to that. But people want to talk about the ideas that are going on here. This is a talk network. We talk about the underpinning ideas of the news. We know that you're a news junkie. We know that you listen to WAMU all the time. Perhaps you've been doing it for a couple of years and never picked up the phone. Perhaps you have given, but you feel like you can give more. Everybody is welcome. Please call 202-885-8850, WAMU.org.
You know, we had a listener who called to say that
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.